Welcome to another edition of Fox on Sports. I am Lauren Fox, and for the next hour, we will talk about the world of sports in Bedford and the world of sports outside. We are joined by Athletic Director Corey Parker of Bedford High School, as well as Minnesota Twins broadcaster Chris Atterbury, who will talk about what it is like to be on what was a horrible team last year, and this past year was a team that lost in the wild card to the New York Yankees. So big changes for the Twins, and also have an opportunity to catch up with Corey as well. But first, wanted to talk a little bit about some sad news that came out of Major League Baseball this week. Cy Young Award winner Roy Halladay's passing. Halladay was a true ace. And when you're talking about an ace in baseball, you think about somebody, you have your regular season aces. You have a guy who can dominate in the regular season. And I hate to say it, I'll use Clayton Kershaw as more of an example there. A pitcher who in the regular season has ease slicing through everybody's lineup. You get him into the playoffs and you're not quite certain. You know that it's the same pitcher. You know that it's the same stuff. But when he's working against a team that's really taking charge of their at-bats, fouling a lot of pitches off, wasting his best pitches, is stacked top to bottom with bats 1 through 9, those guys really can have problems. And there are some pitchers that are postseason aces, and I'll lump Halladay into that one. He was tough during the regular season. He was always tough during the postseason as well. And you think about the Red Sox, they've had their share too. They had Josh Beckett years ago who was one. You think way back to the Dodgers with Oral Hershiser back in the 80s. Mike Mussina was another one with the Yankees back when. Andy Pettit was another one who always, in the case when you got him into the postseason, you knew you were going to get a great start out of those guys. And that was the same thing with a pitcher like Roy Halladay, one who always wanted the ball in every situation. Now, you look back at Halladay's career trajectory, and there's a lot that you can learn if you are a young athlete. First of all, came out in the major leagues, had a good first season, nothing spectacular, and then the second year had one of the worst seasons ever in Major League Baseball history. Threw about 67 innings, an ERA of 10. What did he do? They sent him down to the minors to work on some things. He got an earful from the Toronto Blue Jays coaching staff, and Halladay took it upon himself to figure out what he was doing wrong, learn the mental aspects of the game. And from there, he emerged from the minor leagues as one of the best pitchers in the game. He had what Sports Illustrated writer Tom Verducci called a near-death experience as it pertained to his baseball career, and he used it to fuel himself and to come back stronger. And that is one of the things, as we've talked to some of these coaches with Bedford High and people who are in the sports world, that is one of those things that can separate somebody who is a good player from somebody who is a great player. The best ones are the ones that are experienced in dealing with failure, have a way to come through it, and can get out of it better than they started. Because failure is a natural aspect of sports. No player, no football player is going to complete 100% of his passes. No running back's never going to fumble. Nobody's going to make 100% of their shots. Baseball, if you succeed, the old saying, succeed out of three out of 10 times, you're in the Hall of Fame. If you're a doctor and you succeed 3 out of 10 times, they take your license away. But you have some guys who want the ball, and they care if they succeed, and they care if they fail, and they care mightily either way. But with some of these players, you really get the feeling that they are 100% invested in whatever they are doing. And Roy Halladay was one of those players. Now, we've had the opportunity, like I said, to talk to a number of coaches in Bedford, whether it's people who are involved with youth sports. I'll think back to John Rizzo a few weeks ago, who is the co-president of the Bedford High School or the Bedford Bulldogs football program. And Rizzo is one that I've had the opportunity to coach with over the years. And when you are in that situation and when you are coaching, you want to think about the impact that you can have on a player. The biggest thing is you want to get these kids to come back for the next practice, the next game, the next season, with the ultimate goal that they're going to maximize their ability, that they will put in the work that they need to when they're in the off season to continue to gain enjoyment from the sport. And you realize not everybody's going to make the major leagues. Not everybody's going to make a high school team, but you want them to gain as much pleasure from playing the sports as they possibly can. And you really get the feeling with some of the youth sports, as well as the Bedford High athletic coaches that we have spoken to, whether it's girls soccer, boys soccer, football, they are looking at it more as a long game, ways that they can improve these athletes and improve their attitude and really teach life lessons to these kids as they go. So with that in mind, just wanted to get you up to date on some of what is going on in the world of Bedford sports. The girls cross country meet of champions, Carly Rinko, performed very well. New PR of 18:27. She finished 17th overall for Bedford High School, and that finish qualifies her for the New England Championships in Belfast, Maine this coming Saturday. And after that, we will talk to the Bedford High girls cross country coach next week. So that'll be a part of next week's show. For the girls soccer team, and Corey Parker and I will talk about this a little bit. Great win last week over Exeter down at Stello Stadium, followed by one of the toughest losses that you could ever experience. A game that went through double overtime into penalty kicks. Bedford lost on penalty kicks. It shows up as 1-0 in the scorebook. A great season for that team. Unfortunately, not the ending they would have hoped for. Same thing goes for the boys soccer team as well. They fell 1-0 as the number one seed in the playoffs. Both teams lost to the Central Little Green. So a very tough end of the season for both of those soccer teams, but they need to be proud of what they have accomplished, the hard work that they have put in, the dividends and the lessons that they have gotten out of it. And then the varsity football team, and Corey and I will talk about this a little bit too, losing 34-33 to Winnicunnett on a missed extra point or a missed 2-point conversion try in overtime. But hey, you have the opportunity to score from half the distance of the usual 2-point conversion. You're going to take that opportunity in overtime. That's a great life lesson. If you have an opportunity, you have a chance to win it, you try to win the game right there and then. So a lot going on in the world of Bedford sports. We'll be joined by Corey Parker right after this. Here with Bedford High Athletic Director Corey Parker, who is an optimist, I guess. We'll start by saying that he's always looking for the best in everything. I can say that as a bystander, it was a rough week last week. We had a great girls soccer game Thursday that got them into the finals on Sunday. The 1-0 game at Stellos against a really tough Exeter team. Nice win. And then that leads us right into the finals against the Central Little Green, which, by all accounts, a hard-fought soccer matchup. Very impressive. And unfortunately, it didn't go Bedford's way.
Yeah, great game. Similar to the first game of the year when we played at Gill and beat them, their only actual loss of the year. Just a phenomenal soccer game for 100 minutes. If you're not familiar with the high school, it's 2 40-minute halves. If it's still tied, they go to a sudden golden goal, 10 minutes overtime, followed by another 10-minute overtime. And then, unfortunately, results in PKs, as the fear of the game never ending certainly is on the decision-making process for the state. And so it came down to penalty kicks. And unfortunately, a couple balls didn't go our way, and credit Central for executing and ultimately winning the state championship through penalty kicks, but just a great soccer game for 100 minutes. And talking with the head official after the game and the state director from Exeter, you know, it was one of those games everyone kind of felt that hopefully somebody would score a goal in that second overtime and not result in penalty kicks. But again, it's part of the game. I know it's something that Coach Winning and the team practices, and on that given day, it didn't go our way.
And you referred to the penalty kicks, but happened to talk to one of the parents, Monday. Yeah, it was Monday, so the day after the game. An interesting subtext in the penalty kicks, Lauren Johnson, the goalie for Bedford, actually took one of them and converted kind of, I guess it's the soccer equivalent of a pitcher getting a clutch base hit.
Yeah, it's, you know, I know as Coach Wang and her staff, everyone practices penalty kicks, and it's not something they do all season, but it's definitely once you get into playoffs, it's the reality that is potentially how a game will end in the playoffs. And in the regular season, it's ultimately just a draw after one overtime period. But certainly everyone gets a chance. They take stats. They track that as to who the most confident and best executing in practice are. And for me, it was the first seeing a goalie step up in a penalty kick situation. But credit Lauren, great confidence, great skill, put the ball right in the net for our first kick. And you know, it goes to speak to the volumes of what she brought to that game. She was phenomenal in goal on making decisions and judgment calls on 50-50s and really being a staple of our back line and making sure that ball didn't go in the net. And, certainly penalty kicks for a goalie is a very difficult execution to be successful in that. And it's very different than being a goalie in a game where you're observing the entire play coming in your direction. And so it's, it by no means was a couple goals getting by her in penalty kicks an attribute to how she performed for the 100 minutes of the game, because she was phenomenal in that.
And that's the hardest part when it comes down to it. It's like, all right, we've played through the U.S. Open. We've played our extra 18 holes. Now we're going to have a putting contest.
Yeah. Ironically, I was sitting with Sue Thomas, our girls' basketball coach, during the game. And, it's just a tough way to end, because it's like having a free throw contest to end the basketball game. I mean, it just seems kind of silly. Having said that, I get it from a sportsmanship committee, from soccer committee. Penalty kicks is a part of the game of soccer. And one of those games that doesn't necessarily have a time to an end, much like baseball, per se, it's, I get why the rule's in place. It's just, I think as a fan of the game and certainly that game, I think everybody there would have loved to have seen the game not gone to penalty kicks ultimately.
Right.
It is what it is.
I mean, you get accustomed to watching hockey or basketball at a high level, where occasionally you get these anomaly games that are 4 and 5 overtime games. And by the time all is said and done with something, a game like that, you're basically graded on two things, the physical fitness of your players, the will of your players, and how deep your bench is. Can you sub players in and sub players out? And it's and those things, I guess I'll say it more pointedly, because I don't have to be political quite like you do, although I have to be kind of those to me are far more a measure of who is the better team than penalty kicks are. That being said, they, as in the NHIAA, they want to be concerned about player safety. That's a focus for them. And in their estimation, getting players out on the field for longer than 100 minutes may represent a player safety issue. You brought up sportsmanship, the sportsmanship committee. They have their reasons for doing what they do, obviously. But you really want to see it decided on the field.
Yeah, no, and I give a lot of credit to the soccer committee in this case. I know every year it's discussed. A couple of years ago, there was a discussion about possibly continuing overtime with less players on the field. You see that in field hockey. They remove a few players. And, ultimately, I think they made a right decision in not looking at doing that for the health and safety factor of the players. It's not uncommon in a state championship to have individuals play the entire game, or any playoff game for that matter. And so you're right, you're starting to look at 100 minutes of soccer, which is a real test to the fitness level of a student athlete. And I think the sports medicine committee, along with the soccer committee, really vetted it all through and are always looking at opportunities to improve a game. But certainly the safety and is the highest interest of our student athletes.
We are joined by Bedford High Athletic Director Corey Parker. So moving on, I guess, to the next thing that didn't quite go our town's way over the weekend. Football, 34-33 loss to the Winnicott Warriors, 2-point conversion that failed in overtime. I guess that's the theme of the weekend. It was extra time all the time, right?
Yeah, it was, I would say, from an athletic director perspective, going from the football game to the Spirit Championships on Sunday morning to the soccer state finals, it was three very exciting fan experiences, no question. The football game was a great football game going back and forth. Obviously, being at Winnicott, being undefeated, the place was packed. There was a great amount of support from Bedford fans traveling east on 101, and so it just had the makings of a great environment, great game. The excitement of an overtime procedure at the high school level. Again, for anyone out there listening who's not familiar, giving the ball on the 10-yard line, ultimately, you're given your four chances, assuming there's no penalties, to try to score, whether that's three and out and force a kick for a three-point field goal or trying to score a touchdown and then obviously the extra point. Winning kind of score in their first possession, they kicked their extra point. We scored in our first possession. And then there was a penalty on Winnicunnet, which ultimately put the ball 4.5 feet from the goal line for us. And, you know, the coaches alluded to trying to go for it. And I think it was a great call. And you got to give credit to Winnicunnet in stopping the play. You know, in those situations, kind of like penalty kicks, if it came down to the last kick, it's a make-or-break situation. So the height of enthusiasm for everyone there is at the pinnacle, and credit Winnicunnet for making the stop and stopping our running back, you know, just before the 1 yard line. And, you know, we certainly wish them well this weekend as they move on. And, it's a quick ending to a football season for our kids, but, I give a ton of credit to the coaches and all members of the team. They faced some significant injuries this year, some serious adversity, I think, through that. And when you look at where they were at 3-3, early in the season to ultimately being a yard and a half away from defeating an undefeated Winnicunnet team and top seed in the state, I give them a lot of credit for pushing on, playing with confidence, and like I said, the ball didn't go our way, unfortunately, at the end of the game. But ultimately, through athletics, I think the coaches and the players were able to achieve a heck of a season that they're going to look back on for many years and celebrate.
It really seems from talking to Coach Stank, the emphasis is on digging deep, the next guy up. And a lot of this becomes these almost, I'll call them almost football cliches,
sure.
But they are things for these kids that when you talk to Coach Stank, who played under Coach Mack at UNH, who kind of, he preaches the same sort of things, and he is very matter of fact. But these are lessons that apply throughout life. And so, yeah, you're there and you're trying to win a football game, but a lot of the hard work, and even if it's not your job, it might be your job in a week, you have to prepare like it's your job. All of that sort of stuff is going to apply to these kids when they're at work, when they're in college, you name it. So, you know, regardless of any of that, it's certainly a valuable lesson for the players on this team.
That's the beauty of high school sports. I think regardless of the team, the record, when you represent your school and you put an effort forth as a teammate, you know, regardless of what's going to happen, nothing ever goes smoothly. There's always adverse situations and roller coaster environments for a 16-0 team, an 0-16 team, a 500 team, whatever the case may be. And, you know, that's where I think the kids have great opportunities to learn great examples of life. Through athletics and how they deal with it, how they, you know, grapple with that and move forward, I think dictates a lot and carves their character. And like I said, it's enjoyable to watch. It certainly is.
Here with Bedford High Athletic Director Corey Parker. Now, after we have in large part finished up our fall sports for the time being, we are now on to winter sports. So what can the casual fan expect to see from Bedford High in the winter? And I know we'll tackle some of these on future shows. Either you and sure. I will do it together or some of the coaches will do it. But anything to kind of keep an eye on? Or I know we've talked about some of the marketing initiatives that some of the students have in place to try to get more people out to some of these sporting events. Anything that is particularly fun or worthwhile for somebody who's a casual fan just to head on over to the high school and see and take part in?
Yeah, I mean, I think the immediacy of the timeliness of where we're at right now, the big thing is making sure student-athletes and parents of student-athletes know that sports are quickly approaching. Wrestling and swimming and diving start Monday, followed by alpine ski and gymnastics the following Monday, and then all other team sports the Monday after Thanksgiving, except boys basketball, who's the following Monday, the 4th of December. But the big thing is making sure they've signed up. Excited right now. We've got about 493 athletes that have expressed interest in getting involved this winter, which is awesome. When you consider a school of 1,500, you know, to say one out of every three kids wants to represent the school and be active with an athletic opportunity this winter is exciting. And getting to speak with the captains and some youth organizers, I'm really excited about hopefully bringing some youth to our home basketball games and getting them playing at halftime during the games, and really just kind of strengthening the awareness of what we're offering here. Our unified basketball, which is the most enjoyable thing I've been a part of in 12 years of being an athletic director, where we invite unified athletes and unified partners, similar to the Special Olympics model, to play. You know, those games are obviously great environments for staff, community members, students to come and cheer on some athletes that not necessarily are always wearing Bedford jerseys and have that opportunity now to do so. So those will be big things. I know we're excited to be teaming up with the Bedford Community Pantry here locally, and not only hopefully encouraging people to come to games, but bring donations to help those causes. I know we talked about it previous podcast, and so hopefully as we get into the winter season, you know, really getting more coaches connecting with you and hopefully some student athletes to hear a different voice and hear it firsthand as to the happenings here at the high school.
Yeah, some of the coaches have been a lot of fun going through the fall. They all have their own stories too, and
yeah.
I think as we kind of start to peel the onion a little bit and get in depth with some of these students, that'll be a lot of fun as well, because there are certainly personalities. Obviously, there are stories for any of these kids. They have experiences now playing sports that you or I never dreamed of, as far as the preparation, as far as the training, as far as traveling to play in tournaments. Like when I was in high school, sort of stuff was unheard of. You're not quite as ancient as I am, but these kids have different experiences of working with coaches across the country, playing in programs across the country that they can then share with their teammates as well.
Yeah, you're completely right. And the I guess, ease of communicating that, seeing that through videos, through Vimeo, through highlight reels, it's amazing the opportunities kids have to not only participate in those events, but really get showcased in those events. And I think it's opening a lot more doors for the Division II, the Division III recruiting models, and a lot of kids that may have enjoyed playing high school sports that perhaps weren't recognized, I think are getting recognized by those smaller schools and now are you know, exploring the idea of playing in college to the sports they love at the high school level. And so the opportunities kids have nowadays are endless and great opportunities. And to your point, they're able to experience things that I think we just weren't privy to as student-athletes growing up. So it's exciting. It's also amazing to see our student-athletes and how much they're involved with, whether it's NHS, whether it's the theater, whether it's band, and then also juggling, you know, a very rigorous academic workload and still excelling to the highest of their abilities on the basketball court or whatever the case may be. It speaks a ton to the juggling ability that these kids are able to have nowadays. Again, privy to the opportunities that they have, they're able to excel in all those facets. So certainly when we can share those stories and recognize those students that are taking part in all that, it's a great opportunity to do so.
And I'd request, too, as you're going through and thinking of some of these students, you mentioned the Unified program. There are kids who have an opportunity playing as varsity athletes to work with some of those Unified athletes. And it you and I had touched about this in an earlier interview. I can't imagine coaching younger kids or working with kids in a program like the Unified program when I was in high school and handling it with the level of maturity that these kids do. So keep in mind, anybody that you have who you think is particularly good working with younger kids, working with developmentally challenged kids, we'd love to have them on the show and hear from them as well and kind of get their perspective on things too.
Agreed. Yeah, I'm excited to get through the winter and really through this fall, I've been able to meet a lot of kids, not just fall athletes, but a lot of kids in winter. And yeah, I'd love to get those personalities and those characters involved with you. Absolutely.
Wonderful. Well, as always, Corey, we appreciate the time and good luck as we head on into the winter.
Awesome. Thanks, Lauren. Have a good day.
You as well. Corey Parker, Bedford High Athletic Director. We'll be back after this. back here on Fox on Sports. And yeah, my guest is cringing at the name of the show. I did not name it. The people here at the station named it. We have a special guest. I hope he'll join us after this if I don't scare him away. Chris Atterbury, who is one of the radio voices of the Minnesota Twins and an old friend. Way back in the day, we used to do independent minor league baseball games. Well, we were never together on the air, but we would be in the booth both doing our own games, scowling at each other for talking over each other, if memory serves. The spacious booth up in St. Paul. So
it was spacious.
It was spacious.
Very accommodating. Not like the one in Kansas City where I had to share an office with, like, your sales director.
You got to share an office with Brian Williams, who I think at one point threw a baseball through the wall, and we had to put a poster up over that, just like you would do if you broke something in your mom and dad's house. Brian.
It was Shawshank. It was very Shawshank.
Yes, it was. The Raquel Welch. He was just trying to escape to get into my office, apparently. So, but I will fondly remember the days in St. Paul. They had the best press box food I have ever run across in my life, which I'm told is just an artifact of being in the upper Midwest. But, I mean, where else do you get in a press box and you get the first place I've ever eaten macaroni and cheese triangles fried?
That's true. That's true. And I can counter that by saying that I believe your press box was the first time I ever heard of and or tasted Chipotle. So I don't know if you're looking for corporate sponsorship.
That's really funny.
But that was and Sonic. I think you guys had the first Sonic. And this was before the annoying commercial.
Oh, with the two guys?
Sonic was just like a new thing. And you had one, like, literally right next door. And it rained or lightninged every time we were there.
Yeah.
We were riding out in delays eating Sonic. I mean, that was kind of how it worked.
It's, I'm surprised that I didn't emerge from living in Kansas City with cholesterol that was off the charts, being as we used to eat Sonic. Like, Jenny and I would eat Sonic three times a day because you can cover breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Not to mention, I mean, we all know what minor league baseball broadcasters get paid, those that still exist at this point. But
wait, you were getting paid?
No, I wasn't getting, oddly enough, I was not getting paid to do that. I was getting paid to do the rest of my job and not getting paid for that. But yeah, the Sonic would give us a discount. It was half price on everything. So yeah, of course that was where I ate.
Do all of your colonial friends there in the Northeast, do they understand that you literally went from Orange County, so you went from the OC back when that was a thing?
Yep, it still is called that, yeah.
Well, what we glowingly refer to as the Redneck Riviera, which had a NASCAR track, a Bass Pro Shop, a Sonic, and a Nebraska Furniture Mart. And that was it. That's the list. That's what was out there. And you were on the Redneck Riviera Island. And now look at you. Look how far you've come.
I know. I've gone 3,000 miles from where I started. The amazing thing about that setup over by the racetrack and the baseball stadium in Kansas City was the sheer number of restaurants that were out there. Like, again, you talk about the wonder of a reasonable cholesterol with an Arthur Bryant's in walking distance, Bob Evans, all the things that you can't get. For those who are listening and have not been indoctrinated into Kansas City barbecue, Bob Evans is not that. I lumped it with Arthur Bryant's for some inane reason. But Arthur Bryant's is the Hanover Street Chop House of Kansas City barbecue, if there were a hierarchy of such things. So
it's number one, right? For me, it's number one. We go back a lot, you know, for the Royals, and I know this year there's a new one there called like Q3 or something, and all the guys were gaga over it. And I know for a long time it was Oklahoma Joe's, which now is just Joe's, which I think is good, but I think if it hadn't been in a gas station, I don't think it would have been as popular. But for me, the original Arthur Bryant's down on Vine.
Yep.
With the white T-shirt and the Wonder Bread and the pictures of Jimmy Carter eating barbecue. Like, to me, that was
fun. Pictures of anybody, really, who has ever been present. We were there at one point. It was probably 10 years ago or so. And it happened to be Election Day. And both, within the span of an hour, both Missouri gubernatorial candidates walked in. And we had family in from out of town. We're like, oh, this happens all the time. Like,
I was there.
Bryant's.
Because it's right by the Negro League Museum.
Yeah.
Which, if anybody listening ever goes to Kansas City, you have to go.
Oh, my God, yeah.
It's amazing to me. Every road trip in, I'll be like, hey, guys, who wants to go to the museum with me? And they just roll their eyes at me. We've been there. Come on. I'm like, seriously, this is the place. And I was lucky. I got to do a backstage tour there with Diego Seguí and Jackie Hernandez.
Diego Seguí.
As teenagers, they played in Cuba in the Negro League games, where they had four teams that shared one stadium, and they would just play a doubleheader like twice a week, you know, mismatching who they played against. And they were like 15, 16, playing with these legendary figures. And then they came to the U.S., they played in the big leagues. Seguí used to be the guy that would come in for Satchel Paige when he was a Kansas City A.
Huh.
And he would be in the rocking chair, you know, in the mm-hmm. bullpen. And so we got there, and, you know, and Buck O'Neill comes out, and he sees Diego, and there's like six of us in Diego's pickup truck, which was funny in and of itself. And so the place was amazing. So I took my wife. And then we went down to Arthur Bryant. And it had been like a quiet Wednesday, and there'd been like one other guy in the museum. Well, that guy shows up at Arthur Bryant, which of course you would, because there's literally nothing else.
There's nowhere else to eat
at that time. And so we're like, hey, you can sit with us, you know, because Arthur Bryant is always packed. It turns out he sold caskets and funeral plots.
Seriously.
And I don't know where he was from. It was like a Steve Martin movie or something. I mean, the guy was like traveling around.
Selling shower office. Curtain rings. Yeah.
And he had funeral plots. And we ended up talking to him for a couple hours. Did not buy a plot.
That's good.
But same quote.
Chris Atterbury, who is one of the voices of the Minnesota Twins, talking about some good times back in Kansas City. And yes, the Negro League Museum, that used to be a stop that we made everybody go to, kind of regardless whether they like baseball or not. You mentioned Buck O'Neill. Have you ever been to his grave marker?
I've not.
Okay, no. That's next time you're there, that's him and Satchel Paige are both buried in Forest Hill Cemetery in Kansas City. Another one worth checking out. At least to pay homage to some great Negro League stars. And then you referenced a couple others, and you and I worked together in the Northern League. You had Jackie Hernandez, one of my favorite descriptions ever that you made of Hernandez when he was the third base coach in St. Paul. It's a perfect description. His parenthetical legs.
He did have parenthetical legs. Very bullish.
Yeah, if you look at his legs, he's like a cowboy. His legs are parentheses.
Yeah. We also called it the Latin wing Terwilliger, because we'd had the anybody doesn't know Twig. He'd been in St. Paul, but Wing Terwilliger was a guy from Michigan who was in the U.S. Marine Corps. He was at Iwo Jima. He was at Saipan. There was a picture of him coming out of the jungles of Saipan in battle that ended up becoming a U.S. stamp. He was on the cover of Life magazine with that picture as a young man. That he looks at the magazine and goes, hey, that guy wears his sleeves like I do. And he's like, wait, that is me. He then came back to the U.S. after the war, makes the big league. He turned double plays with Jackie Robinson as a Brooklyn Dodger. He was a Brooklyn Dodger sitting on the equipment trunk when Bobby Thompson hit the shot heard around the world in 1951. He traveled around the big leagues as a utility guy, played with Cubs and all around. Ended up becoming Ted Williams' de facto manager when Williams was the manager for the Rangers. He was the third base coach and essentially the manager because Ted just wanted to hit. This guy then was the first base coach for the Twins when Puck hit the, you know, we'll see tomorrow night home run. He's the first guy to touch his hand. He was one of the most incredible human beings I've ever known. He's still going. He coached into his 90s. Still lives down in Texas, but he was the guy before Jackie. So we went from Twig, true U.S. treasure to the Latin twig, Jackie Hernandez, in his parenthetical
way. Well, and you mentioned Seguí, too, who we'll go back and we'll reference Brian Williams again. I'll never forget Seguí calling Brian Williams, and he would just introduce himself as, this is Seguí. But we got to know Seguí when his son David was playing for the Kansas City T-Bones, and if you're a fan of baseball, no doubt you're a member David Seguí, former prominently as a Baltimore Oriole, but after he had retired from Major League Baseball, came back and we had some bizarre arrangement, as you will only find in independent ball. We had some bizarre arrangement with Segee where, this is David Segee, where he would come and play home games and occasional road games, which I guess is the trade-off when you have a guy who's hitting 369 and really not taking any batting practice. This is the kind of stuff that you get. But that is, a lot of people up here are more familiar, and to a degree, I guess we've had the Nashville Pride where Rich Garce has pitched in his later years.
And, yeah, El Guapo.
El Guapo. I tried to name my dog El Guapo. I got vetoed on that one. If you get another dog, you're welcome to steal that name. The guys that you see in independent ball and the stories that come out of independent ball and the guys who are just kind of fighting to hang on. And then you have the guys like Segee who made $100 million in his career and was riding the buses with us just because he wanted to go out and hit. It's a crazy dichotomy that you get.
Yeah. And I think you and I caught it right at, it was, if you want to use the parallel with U.S. history, it was right after, I would say we caught it in like, post Civil War. Like it was crazy. It was the Wild West when the Northern League first got started. And Pedro Guerrero was rolling dice in the back of a limousine heading to Thunder Bay, Ontario. And then you and I kind of rolled into the westward expansion, Oregon Trail era, restoration in the South. I mean, it was still crazy, but they were trying to put some rules in place. And I think now we've kind of settled in a little more. But, you know, the Twins have mined the independent leagues. It's a great success. Brandon Kinstler was an all-star this year. Came from through Winnipeg and St. Paul. So Chris Colabello, kind of his move into Major League Baseball ended up obviously in some other places. Got dinged for the happy pills, but he ended up you know, having a nice little run for a guy that no one thought was ever going to play. He spent 9 years in Indy Ball.
I was going to say he was in Worcester for 1,000 years. He was an Assumption. He an Assumption College guy?
He was in college.
There you go.
Yeah. You know, we had Craig Breslow was a New Jersey Jackal. We had this last year a couple other guys.
Brad Ziegler's still kicking around.
Yeah, at one point, like half our bullpen had pitched in independent ball, which is the good news and the bad news. And it's an avenue, right? It's the bats and it's the chance to play and. There are stories. There are certainly stories. There was one guy, he'd been in independent ball, and he had been in the big leagues like for a day. And then he was out of it for like 9 years. And in independent ball, and he was bouncing around. And we signed him, a minor league free agent, and we end up calling him up. And I figure he's going to be through the ceiling when he gets to our clubhouse. So I go down, I'm excited to do the – I always liked the indie guys because I was one. And I'm
right.
Like, hey, you're back in the big leagues, blah, blah, blah. It's the exact answer. He goes, and I'm not going to name him. He goes, like, how was it, you know, to get the call? What were you doing? Well, I mean, I was in the middle of dinner, so I totally interrupted dinner. And I had to go all the way back to the ballpark to get my stuff, which was stuck. And the flight was super early. I had to get up really early. I'm like, hey, welcome back to the big league. I wonder why it didn't work the first time.
Yeah, how long did he stick around?
He's been back and forth for the better part of 2 years.
Seriously.
And I guess once you get used to that early wake-up call to force you into that first-class seat to fly to the big leagues, I guess you can get over it.
Right. I mean, it's you wonder if the first time the guy came back, he went, yeah, I was up here for such a short time the last time, this same exact thing is going to happen to me again. Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know.
Moonlight.
Even if it does, geez, why not?
Hey, yeah, take it. Why not? You never know exactly what's going to materialize. We are we're joined by Chris Atterbury, one of the radio voices of the Twins, and I keep identifying him because while his voice may be a household artifact in Minnesota, it is not so much in New Hampshire yet. I mean, you can always come up. Well, no, you could fly up here and we could do basketball games together. You know, that's whatever you want to do. I'd probably make a deal with you on airfare and I'd get you somewhere to stay, but. As in my
house. You
know what?
I don't think I've ever set foot in the state of New Hampshire.
I'm shocked.
I was in Connecticut for 3 years of school, and and we drove around a lot. But I don't know if any of those prep schools, I was like the token poor kid from the West. But I don't know that we ever played any of the prep schools that were in New Hampshire. What are some of the prep schools that are in New Hampshire?
You got New Hampton. You got Tilton.
We played New Hampton, but we played them like in a neutral site. I didn't know where I was. I was so confused. I mean, we're in New York. We're in Massachusetts. I would ask. I'd be like, hey, how far is Boston? How far is New York? How far is this? And they'd be like, everything was 90 minutes.
That's life up here.
We're literally 90 minutes from everything. And I had a bunch of friends who were at Dartmouth, but I never made it up there.
Yeah. Buddy Tevens, come on.
Oh, my God.
I had to drop that for the Stanford guy. The
ruined our program.
So of course you worked your way from Montana to Connecticut. You know, Jeff Fisher is hanging out back in Montana these days. Did you hear that?
Well, yeah, he's got a place up by West Yellowstone. And does a lot of fishing up there. His son played at the University of Montana. He was on the roster, he didn't play a ton, but they've got a little Montana thing going on. I had a friend, in fact, a buddy of mine back home, ran into him at the airport.
Seriously?
A little while ago in Bozeman, yeah.
No, the last I saw was Fisher behind somebody in line at a 7-Eleven. And the joke...
He was one of your guys. He's one of your USC guys.
I know, he's USC guy. I'm hesitant to claim that, but the joke was that when he left the 7-Eleven, it was a 7-9. it's painful. It's a good joke, though.
That is a pretty good joke.
So the Twins last year surprised a lot of people, which no doubt was a lot of fun. Paul Molitor the year before kind of getting his feet wet, setting some expectations. It helps when players mature, too. Some really nice changes within that lineup. But what, for your experience, the year before being with a team where it seemed like not a whole lot was going right, and then to the next year have something where there's a degree of electricity and energy, what's that feel like for somebody who's around the team just about every day?
You know what? Every team has its own personality. It changes a little bit throughout the course of the year. But I would say each season, I've done 11 big league seasons now, each season it kind of has a feel to it when you're there every day. And I joined this club, you know, when they were in 07, and that was a good team. That was the Ron Gardner teams that were in the midst of competing for AL Central titles on a yearly basis. And Maurer and Morneau and Johan Santana, Torrey Hunter, Michael Kadai. I mean, those were good teams. And then 2010, we were really good. And then Morneau gets the concession. And then we got bad. And then Paul came in and we were good. Then we were really bad. And then last year we were good. And it's a chicken and egg thing, right? Like, was it a better feel because we were good, or were we good because it was a better feel? From day one, the year before, man, we just had some turds in the clubhouse, right? We had a bunch of young players, and it's hard to be a young player. You're trying to stay. You're scared you're going to go. You don't know how you fit in. And they were young players we were leaning on. And then the veteran guys we had, a lot of them just weren't willing or able to lead. They were worried about their own. We had a lot of guys, and I point to this a lot. We had a bunch of guys that we signed as free agents who'd never been on a winning team.
Yep.
And it goes back even to the end of Gardy's tenure. We signed like a Ryan Dolman and a Kevin Correa in the offseason. You're like, okay, these guys have been productive big leaguers, and if you play fantasy baseball, you're like, oh, yeah, those guys have had moments. But you go back and look, and they've never finished above fourth place. And I think you get dulled to that after a decade of just showing up to the ballpark, getting your face kicked in, getting your numbers, and then go home. I think you get dulled to it at a certain point. That's not an indictment of that. I just think it's human nature. And so I felt like we needed to find some guys who had an expectation that they would win. That on any given day, it's whose butt are we kicking today? And we found those guys, I think, in kind of some unlikely places. A guy like a Matt Belisle, Chris Jimenez.
Yep.
Guys who've been kind of journeyman types in some respect, but just had this force of personality and professionalism about them, which was precisely what you fold in with a Dozier and a Maurer, and then you get rid of some addition by subtraction with some older disgruntled dudes, and then now you've got these talented young guys like a Byron Buxton who just can blossom. And
yeah.
when you've got a guy like Byron or a Miguel Sano before he goes down, that's the type of guy that you just want to be around. And you just want to show up, because on any given day, there's a pretty good chance, whether it's in warm-ups or the game, that he's going to do something that you've never seen done before. And you want to be part of it. And so the young guys really gravitated to that. We had a real strong Latin contingent headed by Irvin Santana, Eduardo Escobar. And that helps when you've got that, that there's no barrier between the Spanish-speaking side of the clubhouse and English-speaking side of the clubhouse. It's rare, and it's awesome when those two things confuse together. And it felt good from day one, to be honest. I didn't know how many games we were going to win. My anticipation was that we were going to be better. And then the young guys, once they got a taste of winning, you realize, yeah, that's what we're here for. We're here to win. And Molly was great. I mean, he's a genius when it comes to baseball. He's a brilliant man. He's had the highs, obviously, he's a Hall of Famer, and he's had the lows.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I don't think anyone would question that, you know, being on trial in the Pittsburgh cocaine trials wasn't real fun for a guy like that.
Yeah.
He's definitely had his injury issues and his personal issues and demons. And he's a guy that I really think had a lot to do. People debate all the time, well, managers aren't important. You know, we live in this day and age where the front office has to be the smart people. But managers have to make all those players feel comfortable and
right.
And welcome and keep the balance. And Paul's great at that. So it was a real nice feel this year. It just felt like a whole breath of fresh air. And a lot of that, honestly, is the front office guys. We had some new front office guys that came in with ideas but without egos. And I think that's appreciated. I appreciate it as a guy. I mean, you go through this business, and if you're educated, that's a strike against you.
It's true, though.
Years, it's like, oh,
it is true.
Oh, you went to Stanford. Oh, gosh, you're a nerd. Yeah. Get some mud on your cleats and drink some beer, and then you can talk. And that's just, it's wrong in any industry to think that knowledge is bad. And so to have people who welcome ideas and creativity and knowledge, and who instead of saying, well, okay, that's how we always do it, saying, well, why do we do that? Is that the best way to do it? And if it is, we keep doing it that way. And if it's not, we change it. Like that, I think, trickles through the entire organization. And that was awesome. It was really nice.
And it makes sense. And you referenced some of the older guys, some of the more experienced guys, and you almost glossed right through Irvin Santana. I mean, he's been a guy who has been in winning organizations basically from the time that he stepped on a Major League Baseball field. And the expectation with a guy like that, yeah, we all know it's more fun when you win, and we all hopefully have spent time on a team when you're winning, and you spend time on teams that lose. And at that point in time, it's you're relying on some people to kind of right the ship for you. And you get the feeling that a guy like Santana, who has been around, who's confident, who I don't know if he gets the amount of press that he probably deserves at this point, but I wouldn't put him as a frontline ace, but he's a guy who's comfortable getting the ball in a big game situation, and he's not going to let you down. And
well, unless it's New York in the wild card game, in which case he absolutely lets
you
down.
I don't know.
We gave him a 3-0 lead, and Yankee Stadium was like a library, and then he came back and threw the bit.
Playoffs have been an utter mess, or were an utter mess. It's only in the playoffs do you hand Clayton Kershaw a 4-0 lead and wind up losing 13-12.
Yeah, it's a weird deal.
Yeah,
he's one of those guys that I think has always been, I like it, like he's a great bass player. Like, I don't know if you want him fronting your band.
Yeah.
Because he's always had, you know, Jared Weaver on lead vocals or someone like that. But he's a great bass player. And when you got a young guy like a Jose Barrios, having Irvin around is really good. Again, a guy who doesn't panic. And I think that's the hardest thing people don't get, is that as fans, you freak out over every loss and every injury and everything. But as players, it's 7 months, man. You can't overreact. You have to just chill sometimes. And he's good at that. And so, that playoff thing, man, that was horrible. Yankee Stadium was electric, and they're going crazy, and they're chanting the names. And then Dozier hits a leadoff bomb, and we're going crazy. We're up 3-0, and Severino's getting booed off the mound. And then the next thing you know, Irv, the one guy we weren't worried about, it just coughs it up. It was kick in the gut.
Yeah, that's, well, that is playoff baseball. So, Chris Atterbury, radio voice of the Twins, we appreciate the time and look forward to talking to you soon.
Yeah, we'll do it again. And again, what's the show? Fox on Sports?
Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. There, we just did the out.
You are the multi voice of Bedford, New Hampshire.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe so. Welcome back to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. I'm Lauren Fox and wanted to take a brief moment and thank a few people. First of all, our guest, our frequent guest, Corey Parker, the Bedford High Athletic Director, as well as Chris Atterbury, radio voice of the Minnesota Twins, for joining us on the air here today. Again, we wanted to thank the crew at Bedford 105.1 for all the help they put in to ensuring that we have a show to get on the air every week. So as always, thank you to you, the listeners, for taking part in the show. We will see you next week right here on Bedford 105.1.